Welcome to the Bond Brain. And now, without further ado, here's your host, Bud West.
Welcome back to the Bond Brain, where I look to this time get into a little bit deeper of a topic, and that is, now, obviously, as I've said before, anyone who bothers to take the time out of their day to listen to this is a Bond fan. And many of us also go through living and applying the techniques of the James Bond lifestyle. But every now and then I come across an individual within the realm of the Bond community who I think Bond may have had a deeper impact on their life. And more so than myself. You know, for me, Bond is kind of an escape from the mundane. And, you know, I just spent 5 hours doing yard work and I just want to kick back with a martini and watch a Bond film. Or, you know, it may influence the way I dress or maybe a location I go visit. But I think for some people, though, it goes far, far deeper than that. And so I've got a valued longtime member of the Bond community to bring on board here. You know him from the Bond Bulletin and more recently his YouTube premiere of A Bond for Life. Welcome to the Bond Brain, Mr. Benjamin Lind.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. So, you know, I was pushing 30 by the time I really started to get into Bond, but you got into it at a much younger age.
That's true. Yeah, I was 15. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 15. Okay.
Yeah.
And at a time in your life when, you know, in your film, you were going through, you know, some family issues and then family tragedy. And how much did Bond really play in, you know, going through growing up, really?
Well, being exposed to my first Bond film, GoldenEye, was, as I say in the film, an accident. Because back then, that time, of course, 1995, 1996, we still had movie projectors. So what my mom and me wanted to see was Dangerous Minds with Michelle Pfeiffer. And that projector had broken down. So they sent us into the second cinema screen where there was GoldenEye. And I was blown away by what I saw on screen. It was so fantastic, so over the top. And I really became a fan in 97 with Tomorrow Never Dies. And that is what you said, the family tragedy happening in between. My mother died of cancer. That rocked my whole world, so to speak. And sure. In my film, A Bond for Life, I trace back these steps going back to 1996, when I saw GoldenEye, I went to the original cinema where I saw it. It's, you don't know it in the film. It's very briefly seen. But I went back to these places where my youth happened. So it's part dealing with my own past, making a check mark behind it, leaving it behind, realizing that these things happened. And Bond stayed with me all this time. So Tomorrow Never Dies was really much more on top of GoldenEye. It was more over the top. It was bigger. It was better. It was more style, more glamour. The music by David Arnold, you know, I mean, don't have to say much about that. And this really threw me into the Bond craziness, you know. And I was 15 at the time when my mom died. And I collected everything that had anything to do with 007, newspaper clippings, video cassettes, obviously, and the music, CDs we had at the time, no MP3 or stuff. It was an exciting time, yeah. And it was certainly very interesting to go back in time to the original places, film there, see how they changed. Not much has actually changed. It rarely does in Germany when you travel to these places. But
okay.
It was really great. So what happened in the film was the first hour is sort of like an explanation of how my life went from that time seeing GoldenEye until my mom died and Bond started changing my life and being there for me in difficult times. I interviewed my cousin in the film who took me in after my mom died. And she says that I lived in a dream world very much encapsulated by this dream world and was very difficult to get me out of it, which was a good thing because it sheltered me in a way. It blocked the outside world, but I did not let anybody in to me. And that has certainly changed. I became active in the Bond world in 2012. So it's a lot of time in between. But I followed the production of the Bond films, but pretty much on my own. So, and with starting the Bond Bulletin, I wanted to write. I wanted to do something, share my opinion, and get in touch with other fans, something that they have done for years before that. And now I'm pretty much, yeah, established, as you said in the beginning, and I'm really happy to be a part of this great community. Yeah.
Yeah, you've been you've been one of the channels I've been following for a long, long time, and many, many years before I ever started doing a podcast or YouTube or anything. You know, you say you kind of retreated into that world, but I think a lot of kids kind of do that. It's not always a film or a franchise. It you know, for me, that was sports. I mean, if somehow a ball was involved, I didn't care about anything else. I mean, to the point that I would lose girlfriends because, hey, we got time on the ice rink. Let's grab the skates and you know, the skates and the sticks. I think that everybody does that. For you, it was Bond. It always intrigues me when someone grasps the Bond films at a younger age. I mean, for me, seeing it at 16, I felt like I just paid money to watch my father shoot people and get lucky because, you know, Roger, for me, well, that would be Roger Moore, who's kind of running around. And I'm like, oh, my God, this old guy. Like, you know, and it took a little while for me to kind of warm up to it. But then you actually go into trying to, or just making a fan film. How long did you actually, you know, plug away at that?
Oh, you mean the Y Countdown, the fan film?
Yes,
I speak about in my film. Yeah, that was weird.
I don't think so, but
well, you should have been there. It was really fantastically weird. What I didn't mention was I did make a fan film before that. So after I saw GoldenEye, there was already my first exposure to a fan film. I didn't mention that because it would have blown the film out of proportion. And no material whatsoever survived from that because I sent it to a television station. Sometimes they pick these things up just for fun.
Right.
But it was a learning curve because I was at a boy's home at that time because I had trouble with my mom. We were fighting most of the time, and the owner had a camera, and he said, "You can have that camera if you deliver me a script." So it had a learning effect. Yeah, it had a learning curve.
Well, you're and making films now. You must have learned something. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty much the improv type. Yeah. I improvise most of what I do. I hate scripts. And I didn't have a script for A Bond for Life. I had an outline, and I knew what story it was supposed to tell, but I did not often refer to a script sometimes. I mean, when I filmed in Austria, I had a script about Ian Fleming's time in Kitzbühel, just to have some random notes in there to not say something wrong that didn't happen. So it had to be historically accurate. But otherwise, no. And at a very young age, when I got that camera, we did really a 12-minute film or something like that, with jumping out of a car. I know it was a Mitsubishi Space Wagon. I remember that. It was very, very, very surreal.
Very slick. Yeah.
But that was fun. And somebody gave me a tuxedo that didn't fit. And I remember from the old footage that I still have in my head, there is one scene where I totally look like Timothy Dalton. And Bond is locked up in a sauna and is about to get burned to death. Yeah, that's what I remember in that scene. That, obviously in a tux, yeah, which makes the thing even hotter. But right. Doing it for a second time was ambitious. The technology didn't evolve much, so it was still handheld camera. It was a camcorder. Sure. And yeah, I just threw together a team. I had an outline, I had a script, but no dialogue. I didn't script any dialogue. We made that up on the go when we were rehearsing. But it had a certain structure. It had the gun barrel, it had a main title sequence, it had an opening sequence, a pre-title. And then we had a lot of location shooting, but what I didn't think about it, I went there alone on location. So most of what I filmed was just Bond doing stuff. he went to Austria just to get a piece of information, which is absolutely rubbish. But it looked better on paper and in your head than it was actually on film. But yeah. Some of the scenes are the fun it was to film it. When I look at the material, it's laughable, but it was fun. Yeah, it was fun.
Well, I think most of us look back at videos of ourselves, regardless of what we were doing at 15 and 16, and kind of laugh at that stuff.
And I had so many comments of people saying, I made a fan film too at that age. And so pretty much everybody did that. It's amazing.
Oh yeah, everybody picked things. They tried Star Wars, and we would make joke films, you know, just somebody in a bathing suit shoveling snow, and just it was always just kind of for laughs and stuff, never anything long.
Absolutely. But,
I don't like to work from scripts. I tried that when I started the podcast, and I just like just reading, you know, I said, I'm going to type this up and read it so it sounds professional, and it just sounded stiff and wooden. And so, like, I do everything off the cuff. Occasionally, I have to edit some stuff out, and I'm like, oh, well, you know, I probably shouldn't have cursed there or something like that. But, if anybody heard my original podcast early on, there's a lot of missing F-bombs and it is a learning curve. I mean, you know, how did you handle audio in those days with just use the camcorder speaker?
Pretty much. There was nothing else that we could have done. So when we had outdoor filming, you had to be really close to the subject you were filming. But the microphones were quite good. I learned to stick to Panasonic for a long time. I only use Panasonic cameras. I shot A Bond for Life on a Panasonic camera. It was just a 1080p, normally a photo camera, but it has a 1080p video function. But that was really enough. You wouldn't call it professional. If you go to a photographer, he would probably say, go for a Nikon or something else. But it was enough. And I think the microphones back then were a lot better. They picked up more and the sound was more natural. Of course, today we work with microphones, with little clip-on microphones and stuff like that. When I did Bluetooth A Bond for Life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't trust Bluetooth when it comes to microphones.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I need a cable thing, and I just got myself a recorder with a microphone in, and I had my really long, I think, 3-meter microphone cable, and whoever I interviewed, I had to say, I'm sorry, I have to fiddle in your trousers. Oh. I have to stick all of that in your trousers. And when you watch the film and you see the interview with David Arnold, that was the first interview I did, you can see the cable between us because the recorder was in my pocket and the clip was on his jacket.
Oh.
So.
But you guys were sitting in that coffee area, weren't you?
We were standing in the exit of the Royal Festival Hall in London. Yeah.
I was waiting
for him in there. So this is well behind security. This is where they come out and sign. And I did something that you normally don't do. Well, I wrote to him on Facebook, and he said, it's no problem. We took a photo 2 years earlier, so I sent him that. And I said, hey, I'm that ugly guy on the left. Would you like to do an interview for a charity documentary? And I told him a little bit about it, gave him the outline, and he said, you've been to the festival hall, you know where to find me. And so I went round after the concert. Was shielded by my group of fans because we were the first in line and they defended that line. And when he came out, I jumped at him immediately and pulled his jacket and said, hey, I'm the guy who wrote to you on Facebook. I was so nervous. It was so unprofessional if I look back on it. But then there was this sliding door and there was a big security man behind it, and David Arnold just gestured me in there, and I went past this big guy, and I saw from the corner of my eye, I saw Brian May standing at a long hallway, and they all passed by me and I couldn't do anything. I couldn't move because if I went out again, well, I just watched him sign CDs and stuff, and right. Yeah, waited patiently. I mean, waited over an hour for him to come back in. Yeah, but that's what you do.
Well, yeah, you have to. I think when you're going to do something like that, you got to be a little pushy.
Yeah. Patience. Yeah.
Yeah. And now, A Bond for Life, you actually got that into some cinemas, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah, we had the world premiere was here in my hometown. The plan was to make it much bigger, but I sent out invitations. I made VIP packages because there was an after party, which was, of course, also for UNICEF. And everybody who bought a ticket, a combi ticket for the film and the after party, had a little bit of a higher price, but all of that we gave to UNICEF. And depending on how many people actually came, the cinema said, okay, you can't have the big screen because that's obviously 650 seats. It's a bit much if you turn up with 90 okay. people. So in the end, 90 people saw the film in a cinema, I think, for 200. But it was nice. And I've always said, if I can make 90 people happy, it's okay. It's the same that goes on at YouTube. I don't need videos with 60,000 views. If I can make 300 people happy, I'm happy. Absolutely.
Right.
It's not about the big numbers. No. And these 90 people had fun, and it was emotional because my family was there, my best friend was there, everybody I interviewed, so they saw that footage for the first time. And I know how to make people grab their handkerchiefs quickly. So even before the film started, we had sort of a making of video with Whitney Houston's One Moment in Time. And I said, everything we do in life, everything we experience is one moment in time. It will never repeat itself. So, and with that, I sent people into this evening. And this already had people crying. And I just said, well, wait, what's about to come for the next 2 hours? And of course, people who know me, my family and my friends, they are a bit more emotional because they know my story. Everybody else, I had students of mine, because I'm an English teacher, students of mine were also in the screening. Of course, they're a bit younger. They thought, they were there to learn English, so that was the thing, because the film's in English. But they were impressed. Yeah, they were really impressed. And we auctioned a magazine cover that I had signed. I collected signatures at the Spectre World Premiere from pretty much everybody, down to the helicopter pilot from Mexico City. So, and this went in 60 seconds. This went for €350. So after 60 seconds, it was gone. Yeah. And all of that money went to UNICEF. And just this evening raised $2,500. And we made a photo with the check in front of our palace here in Brunswick. And the newspaper came and stuff. And it was nice. It was nice. Yeah. Right. It was really good. And then I was invited to Spain by the Spanish fan club. They sort of have a loose fan community that they label as a fan club, but you don't really get a membership card or something, but they have a magazine and stuff. Very, very friendly, very, very nice. And they paid for everything. And we had a small little cinema, very private, something you can rent. And they translated everything I said. This was fantastic. And a great, great friendly community down there, the Spanish. And they totally forget that you don't speak their language. They just speak Spanish.
Oh. Yes, I know.
I mean,
we were in the Dominican Republic and it was the same thing. Fortunately, my daughter is able to speak what we call bar Spanish, so she can order drinks. And but they just keep talking.
I can do a little bit of every language. But my Spanish is not for conversation. No, definitely not. I had during filming, I had problems with French as well. When we interviewed Béatrice Libert, Castle Boulevard, my friend from Paris was next to me and he translated my questions and he later typed me the subtitle that you see in the film because I couldn't do it. I understand when they speak together, I can understand them, but I cannot reply. This is horrible, but I had French in school, but I forgot everything. And I had it in school when it was a very difficult time for me, so I didn't pay attention to most of the stuff in school.
Yeah, I had I had 4 years of it, and I think I can count to 10, and that's probably about as far as I can go with it. So anyone who can speak more than one language is one language ahead of me. So, right.
Counting to 10 in French gets you 10 bottles of champagne.
Yeah,
there you go. Switzerland. Yeah.
Okay. And your filmmaking has not stopped. You've just announced a new project.
Absolutely. Yeah. Bonded by 007. It was a spur of the moment idea, actually. I was on Twitter the other night, and Ian Jacklin, a very high regarded fan in the community, he was the one who tried to save this George Lazenby lamppost in London.
I know who you're talking about now. Yeah,
absolutely. Something that was absolutely necessary, and thank God he did that. And he wrote that he rewatched the documentary Everything or Nothing, which was a fantastic documentary on Bond. Right. And he said, wouldn't it be great to have something like that from the perspective of the fans? And I immediately wrote under it, I'll be up for it. I'll do it. I have the equipment. I can do it. Not knowing what I threw myself into. But it's these passion projects, when you automatically have a vision, you should follow it through. And if I see a plan to realize it, why not do it? And this is easier to do than filming a Bond for Life, which was filmed in 7 countries. A lot of traveling, a lot of interviews, a lot of tension. Setting up scenes and knowing in advance how they look like. For this film, Bonded by 007, speaking to the fan community, it's just I have to record interviews. That is easy because I put people in front of the camera or we record it on Skype when the people live far away, because I have now gotten over 50 participants who want to share their story with 007. So, I have to do over 50 interviews, most of them with video on Skype. Because I have people from Mexico, from Norway, Sweden, even Syria. So we touch a lot of countries, a lot of individual fans, a lot of age ranges. And I've booked a weekend getaway to the middle of Germany, which is where the opening will be filmed. And I will meet a 63-year-old American expat who lives here in Germany. And he wants to share his story growing up in Bond Mania in the 60s. And this is my outline for the film. It starts with people telling their story growing up in the 60s and 70s, where we didn't have internet and the world being so connected as it is today. So how was fandom at that time? I'm very much interested in that.
I mean you couldn't just sit down and pop in a disc or stream. Like, people don't even into the 80s, people don't understand, you know, didn't you have all of these on videotape? I'm like, well, you know, even in the 80s when there were only 15 films, I mean, in today's money, to have all 15 of those films at the prices, it would have cost you, you know, the equivalent of today of about $1,000 to get these. And then, you know, I mean, now we look at, a $25 disc, but a $25 tape back then was about $60 now. So not everyone could just, they didn't pop up on all your streaming services. You couldn't just, watch a Bond movie at the drop of a hat. I mean, people don't really realize how spoiled you know, we are in that respect, you know.
Absolutely. We've got everything now. We've got everything at the touch of a button. And I mean, just what we do now, recording a podcast episode, first of all, in the 70s, 80s, it didn't exist. Even in the 90s, it didn't exist. What would you have done to speak to me? We would have been on a long distance call via phone. Yeah. And then how do you record that? I didn't do it in the 90s, so I don't know.
No, you're right. Probably. Well,
you would have had to record the receiver with some mechanical device. So
yeah,
it was possible, but
they had adapters that plugged it. You would plug the phone line into that and plug it back into the phone, and you would call when it would go on to a cassette tape. I don't know I don't know anyone that had one. I know they existed, but there were ways. But yeah, it was just, you know, not what it is today. And I look back and I'm thinking, like, all of the podcasts and YouTubes that kind of kicked off in the middle of the pandemic because people didn't have anything else to do, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, so they had an outlet. We could all talk on Zoom and Skype and StreamYard and whatever technology you wanted to use. And it kind of kept people sane. And I think, like, wow, like, what if this had occurred 30 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it would not have been.
No.
Even to organize the gatherings that we have now, like, you know, the 007 Great Britain Club or the stuff that the Bond Experience does over here in the U.S. I mean, yeah, you know, you get up and you take 3 seconds and you've contacted thousands of people. And it's...
Yeah. And yeah, traveling is easier. I mean, in the 90s, I know I had once booked New York. I wanted to visit New York in the year 2000, I think it was. And I know we still had our old currency. We weren't on the euro. We had still the Deutschmark. And it was around 5,000 to go to New York. And of course, yeah, knowing me, I was always the luxury guy, staying at the Four Seasons, I think, with a view over Central Park. That's what I had booked, but I got seriously ill and couldn't do it. So all of the money went down the drain. But today, from Berlin, I mean, you can get a flight to New York for 300. That's nothing. That's absolutely nothing. So under 1,000 euros, you can comfortably go to New York for a couple of days. So the world has shrunk, actually, for all of us. So these gatherings are possible because most people can afford to travel within their own country to do that. I know we have the same things here. We have the German Club, and we cooperate with the Swiss and the French. Going to Italy or going to France, things like that. And for us, it's easier and affordable. In the 90s or the early 2000s, this would have been, you would have thought twice about doing that for a weekend. Yeah.
Oh, just for a weekend. Absolutely. Yeah. That's kind of a long way. Just back in November, I think we probably spent about 10,000, but 10,000 got us to Athens, Cairo, all roughly the same type. Turkey, we went to Ephesus, we went to, well, you know, we bounced all over the Mediterranean, three different continents, and you know, it wasn't like 5,000 for just 3 days in the same spot, you know. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a tough call. You got to get to New York, man. You got to get over. That's
As we have to all these papers to fill out. That sort of keeps me from doing it. But I looked at flights to New York, but they've, depending on when you want to go, now the weather gets better, summer is coming, the prices go up. And now I have this project, so I know where I need to go for this film. Because it will be a mixture of real life interviews in person. And I know I will be going to London in October to see Cue the Music in the O2.
Okay, with the O2.
And I can do a lot of interviews there, but not all of them. I did not expect so many people replying to my idea. And now I have to go twice to London, I think. I have to go in summer at some point.
Okay.
I have to go to the Netherlands to Amsterdam, because there is a big fan community, the Dutch. And I can interview several people in one day at the filming locations of Diamonds Are Forever. So that is really a fantastic thing. I want something visual in the background as well.
Sure.
You know,
yeah, sure.
Just like a Bond for Life, where we had a good mix of real Bond locations like Piz Gloria, things like that. But also other locations like Belfast, which is connected to my friend's story. My best friend's father is from Belfast. So that's why we filmed there. It's an important place for her, not so much for me, and not connected to Bond in any way, but it just looks good. It looks really good.
Right.
And in Amsterdam, we filmed as well. I did the interview with Martijn Mulder there and with Remmert van Braam, and with Morten Steingrimsen, a Norwegian fan. So a few location pieces must be in there to make it really attractive. I think Vienna will be on my schedule as well, because there are many Austrian Bond fans that I hold in high regard, and Bond in Motion will move there, obviously. What else? I think Belgium I have to go to. Yeah. But that's, at the moment, that's all that will be done on location. London covers a lot, I think, because there are many, many British Bond fans who I would like to interview in person. Yeah.
I think there's quite a few people from this side coming over for that event, too.
Yeah.
Yes. Unfortunately, one of them will not be me. But, I wish I could make it over. I would love to see Cue the Music in any venue, let alone the O2. But
absolutely. Yeah. Have you seen the concert rerun? It was
No, it was
fantastic. Yes,
I haven't queued that one up yet. We were out all day on Sunday when he did the rerun live stream. But yeah. That's something
really,
I will.
This is of a quality that not many orchestras can match. I mean, I've seen a lot of orchestras performing Bond titles, instrumental and stuff, but only the main title songs mainly. When you have good arrangers who spice it up with their own interpretation, it's really, really good. Like I have a 12-minute instrumental recording of one of our television orchestras. We've got these big television orchestras that we fund with our taxes, so they can at least play Bond. And they did it really nicely. It is a fantastic mix. It is a really great quality. And sometimes they slow down songs. Sometimes they speed them up. They speed up All Time High, so it becomes almost a pop song. It's really fantastic. Oh. But Cue the Music, they rearranged things like The World Is Not Enough boat chase that opened the concert. I mean, this throws you right into the mood. And you don't feel the runtime of a 2.5-hour concert when you listen to Cue the Music. And I've seen them live on Piz Gloria. This was a quality and such a dedication by all of these musicians and the performers. It's just fantastic. They are in it with their heart and soul. And you don't often find that today. Orchestras, they play a program that they are paid for to do. But being behind it with heart and soul means more than just playing notes, you know. And Cue the Music certainly does more than just playing notes.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife and I took a trip up to Toronto it's probably 2019 now or 2020, very before the pandemic. And we saw Skyfall done with a live orchestra. Mm. And that was, you know, phenomenal just to see a film with a grand score like that. And, you know, a lot of the other Bond fans that were there were saying, you know, that's the way to see the film. But I've noticed a lot of people say Cue the Music kind of takes it up a notch, that they just take it to another
level.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
On my bucket list. And at one point they had stopped playing, had they not?
They had, yeah, because it was difficult for Warren to support this whole thing. And this costs a lot, operating an orchestra, maintaining that, renting venues, balancing ticket sales versus renting venues. I don't know the exact inside story but it all got a bit much money-wise and time-wise. Sure. I mean, his whole time as the band leader went into keeping this orchestra together and maintaining their performance level, you know, always finding new venues, having a tour, putting a tour together. And whoever is a musician, well, I'm not, I've never been on tour, thank God, except from here to there. But this is strenuous always. And it costs so much money. Everything costs money. And I know, especially in the UK, a lot of things cost money. I never took my film A Bond for Life to the UK because it was very difficult to work with UNICEF over there. They basically did not help me in any way to get a venue, which they could because it's a charitable organization.
It's charity, but
so different from here. Here, I went to my local UNICEF office and I said, this is what I have planned. What can you offer me? Of course, I rented the cinema for myself, but the cinema gave us the screening room for free. They just sold tickets in-house. I sold tickets and they sold tickets in-house and later gave me the money because it was clear from the start that this is for charity. The cinema did not keep one single penny. Right. And in the UK, it was really, 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 really difficult. I mean, I had help from an actor, from a friend, Derek Lyons, who said, speak to this cinema, speak to this cinema. It's a local small cinema. They would love to do that. I did. I tried. But still, the price tag was not in my price range. And I was not ready to invest money in showing a charity film. Because in the end, I make a minus.
Yeah, that's...
And I just didn't have that money.
It's tough over here too. They're a little more open to it now. I actually ran a cinema for 4 years, and we were, I managed one for a chain, and we weren't allowed to do any of that stuff. So it didn't really even matter if it was for charity. They wouldn't know it because they weren't going to make a buck over it. So you had to really go to the art house kind of places here, to do it. And there's more of those now, and I think that the cinema is kind of suffering so bad now. They're being a little more open about that stuff and allowing
it
in. But yeah. So, anything else you would like to add before we wrap up here?
I would definitely recommend to visit my YouTube channel, of course, to get some information on Bonded by 007. So if you like to participate, I'll be happy to receive your message on all my socials, on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook. If you want to be interviewed by me for the film, we can do it with Skype, with Zoom. I have all the options available to record your story with 007. I rather have more than too little. I mean, A Bond for Life, we filmed over 57 hours of film, I think, which resulted in a 2-hour, 4-minute movie. So it's always good to have more. And because I don't know how I will edit it, how it will come together. I think, and this is the difficult, this is a tricky thing. I think a lot of fans will have similar stories. So I will hear many stories being the same. And then, of course, it is my job not to edit them all together and tell a story repeatedly, which is the same story, but to find something in every story that is different. That will be the interesting thing, or that something that adds up to what other people in the film say, you know? And with over 50 people participating, I mean, that's quite a number. I mean, Bond fans in the world, how many do we have? Millions.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but 50, doing an interview schedule for 50 people is hard enough. Yeah. But still, I'd be happy to get as many voices as I can probably get, as I can possibly get, to get a really good film that is about us, the community. Yeah. And I want to speak as little as possible.
Okay. That's awesome. So anyone out there, you are still listening here, I'm sure. check out the Bond Bulletin. Anyone heavily involved in the Bond community has obviously heard of the Bond Bulletin. And take the time to watch A Bond for Life. I've found it to be an inspirational story, and Bond affecting an individual in a manner that is a lot deeper than it was for me. And I'm always kind of interested to hear those. Thank you very much for doing this, sir. It's been great to connect, and more to come from the Bond Brain, and more to come from Mr. Lind here too. He's promised us. So, right, this is Bud West with the Bond Brain. The Bond Brain will return.